This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. I'm Ian Denemy, this week joined by Hockey News writers Ken Campbell, Ryan Kennedy, and Matt Larkin. This week we'll be talking about the Dennis Wiedemann suspension, what's gone wrong in Montreal, and the return of Connor McDavid. Thanks for coming along. Okay, so let's start by talking about Dennis Wiedemann. He was suspended 20 games yesterday. It's the big news. Ken, you've been on this beat kind of from the start. Let's start by talking about the suspension itself. 20 games, too much, too little, or where does it end up after the appeal?
Well, the sense that I'm getting is that basically the NHL erred on the side of caution on this one. Like, they went as far as they could go. Then that way, you know, once Wiedemann appeals it to Gary Bettman, if Gary Bettman says, okay, I'm going to keep it at 20 games, then he goes, then it goes to an independent arbitrator by a guy by the name of James Oldman. And so anyways, I think what the league is saying to its referees is, look, we're looking out for you guys, right? We got your back, so to speak. You know, it's not our fault that the arbitrator cut it down to 8 games or 7 games or 10 games. We did the best we could. And I think that's what the NHL is doing here right now. But, you know, as I wrote in a blog yesterday, I think this whole thing opens up a huge can of worms with the NHL's concussion protocol. And, like, basically it looks like a player can say to a trainer, F you, I'm not going to the quiet room, and he doesn't have to go in some cases. And that's, to me, that's a huge, like, enormous, like truck, semi-truck-sized hole flaw in this whole system now, so.
It really seemed like, when you look at the incident as a whole, it was almost like if this was a criminal trial for something else, that would have been, like, the big sort of, you can't incriminate yourself and be like, yeah, I was totally concussed and had no idea where I was, but I sat on the bench after.
Yeah, and played the rest of the game.
And played the rest of the game. But I didn't mean to do that. Like, right. It was sort of like, you know, there was like a double indemnity plead the fifth on this one, Judge.
Like, Wiedemann, he was in a tough spot. I think he didn't want to throw the Flames under the bus, or he didn't want to admit that he was woozy, but his story didn't match up with the footage. Like, his head was up. He said his head was down, but clearly if you look at the tape, his head was up. It was an aggressive move toward the player, toward the referee, I should say. So the story just didn't match up, and to me it really supports the idea that he wasn't right in the head. And, you know, I'm a concussion guy. I've talked a lot about having post-concussion syndrome myself.
You've had a lot of bangs.
I've had a lot of bangs in the head.
That explains a lot.
It does explain a lot. Yeah. And my head is really big, and it gets in the way of stuff. Yeah, the beard protects my face a little bit. But, you know, the story I always tell is when I was a little kid, I had a horrible concussion, and I lost half an hour of memory. People told me what I did after. I spoke. I walked home from school. I really annoyed my babysitter, apparently. She said I was screaming all the way home. I had no memory whatsoever of the incident. So that's the element of what happened that causes me to defend Wiedemann a little bit. I actually genuinely believe he was not in his right mind.
It's like the NHL's definition of intent and his definition of intent, they're not matching up here, right? Like, the NHL is saying that intent, and it's very clearly states in the rule book that for purposes of this of a penalty, intent to injure means that you knew. Or should have known that what you were going to do was going to cause an injury, right? So that's kind of interesting. And I think there's so many layers to this thing. Like, now if a guy goes, you know, gets smacked along the boards, turns around, pulls a Todd Bertuzzi, and says, "Hey, I was concussed at the time." Mm-hmm. What are they going to say? Well, the NHL is saying right now, at least, doesn't matter. You're still accountable for what you do. Like, to me, this whole thing is like super interesting.
The one thing that I haven't seen yet, and I feel like there's some sort of Zapruder footage out there, is another angle of Wiedemann hitting him. Like, you always see it from behind. I'd like to see Wiedemann's face.
Yeah.
And see, like, what, you know, like, what is he emoting at the time? Is he angry? Is he just like, you know, is he dazed? Like, what's going on there? I think that was what I was waiting for, and I still haven't seen it, and I think that would have cleared up a lot if there is.
Well, because it just looks like he's saying, F you,
get out of my way.
You know, like, he looks, like, the way the video looks, it looks really damning to him. It looks like he's really pissed off about there being no call, about him getting hit, and he sees this linesman in front of him. And, I mean, if it had been a Nashville player, he probably would have done the same thing.
Totally.
You know, I mean, it looks really damning because it just looks like he says, get the hell out of my way, and pushes him
it's
down.
It's explosive. The movement's explosive.
And there's a follow-through.
There's a big follow-through. Yeah. The question now is there a such thing as unconscious intent? Because sort of my conspiracy theory is an unconscious Dennis Weidman was trying to retaliate on was it the Preds? It was the Preds, right?
Yeah.
Preds player, and didn't realize that he was hitting an official.
I don't know, man. There's eight. I measured it on my handy dandy little Timex stopwatch at home, and there's 8.6. According to my theory, according to my findings, there's 8.65 seconds between the time he gets hit and the time he hits Henderson.
Yeah.
Okay, so like, I just can't believe that. He, you know, he had that time to get up, skate, tap his stick on the ice to tell his teammates that he's coming off the ice, too. So he's got the presence of mind to do that. He's banging his stick on the ice to tell him he's coming off, and then he looks up and sees a guy with a black and white sweater and thinks it might be a guy on the Predators.
But he's not conscious.
What if
he's not conscious? Again, going back to my childhood story, I got to keep pounding the drum on my childhood, apparently. I lost half an hour. My theory is that Weidman doesn't remember any of that game.
And to be devil's advocate with the stick tap, is that maybe just something that is so instinctive to him that he's literally going through the motions of what you would do on a shift?
Yeah, maybe.
Muscle memory.
Yeah,
muscle memory. There you go.
Yeah, Ken, you wrote last night that you had the scoop that he was diagnosed with a concussion. The concussion spotter said he shouldn't have gone back.
Yeah.
Obviously, he did. What does that say about the protocol, and what are the consequences for not following that protocol?
It says the protocol clearly broke down completely somewhere, and from what I gather, it broke down in the time that the Flames trainer, and I think it's a guy by the name of Kent Kubelka, that's who it looks like, is talking to Weidman. You can see he's talking to Weidman. I don't see Weidman saying anything back to him. What I was told by my source was that the trainer went to Weidman, said, you know, that the concussion spotter did his job. He spotted symptoms of a concussion. He went to the Calgary bench. Said you got to take this guy to the quiet room, or you got to, you know, I've red flagged this situation, which is exactly what they're supposed to do. And then the guy went to Weidman, and from what I was told by my source, Weidman said, "F you, I'm not going anywhere." And then that was it. I didn't, in the footage that I've seen, I don't see Weidman saying anything to the guy. And what we also don't know is, okay, so this guy, if it is Kent Kubelka, the athletic therapist for the Flames, okay, so if he goes to Weidman, Weidman says, "F you, I'm not going anywhere." So then what happens? Did he go to Hartley? Did he go to one of the assistants? Did he go to Martin John or one of the guys on the bench and say, "Look, this guy can't go back on the ice"? I don't know that. I don't think anybody knows that at this point. And I think we're probably going to find out in the next little while. It'll be interesting to see, you know, it's as we sit here right now, it's like 11 o'clock Eastern time, 9 o'clock in Calgary. I don't imagine the Calgary Flames have practiced yet. I wonder if Dennis Weidman's going to be in practice today. You know, he was well enough to fly to Toronto for the hearing, right? Mm-hmm. So that would indicate what? That his concussion symptoms might have abated by that time?
Right.
I mean, to me, though, that with this, like, the bigger picture here is beyond the suspension is how. So, if this is happening, if it basically a player can say "F you, I'm not going anywhere," how often is that happening in the league? And really, how much teeth does the NHL's concussion protocol have? Doesn't appear that it has.
And the spotters. To me, what I'm wondering is what real authority do the spotters have? You see on social media people saying, "Where were the spotters?" But as we see here, the spotters did their job.
Exactly.
It seems like they're being ignored by team physicians and team trainers. So if that's the case, what's the point of
the spotter? Well, no, the spotter has no authority. The spotter is there basically to red flag something he thinks might be a concussion. That's all the spotter can do. Spotter has no authority.
No authority, no medical training. But if they're being ignored every time, then what's the point of their existence?
Well, is there not a legal implication that the NHL, especially with a class action suit against them right now, says we're doing things,
mm-hmm.
and the players, who I guess technically are represented by the PA in this sort of scenario, they're ignoring us, so
right.
we wash our hands. We believe, you know, in player safety. We have these spotters. The trainers tell them. If they ignore us, we can only do so much. They are, you know, adults.
And,
with their
yeah,
own
and I don't disagree with that. Like, I mean, you know, what can more can the league do? They have a guy close to the bench that spots, tells the team. The trainer was obviously told. Trainer talked to the player, and the player shut it down from there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean,
it's not like you can suspend a guy for not following concussion protocol.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how many of these guys in this concussion lawsuit probably were in the same boat at one point. You know, got hit in a game, don't remember half of what happened, and went out and played most of the game. You know, I mean, I talked to a player, and I'm not going to say who it was, during his career. He's retired now, and he was talking about this whole concussion thing, and he said to me, he said, "Why is this guy complaining? I've had a headache for 11 years. You know, like, I've had headaches for 11 years, and I'm not complaining." And that's, like, that's unfortunately the kind of thought process you're dealing with these guys.
Yeah, it says a lot about the culture. I mean, the league, whether it's the NHL, the NFL, can put in all these protocols and steps to curb. But if a player is saying, "No, I'm going back out there and playing. F you, I don't want to go to the dark room."
Yeah.
I mean, how do you prevent that? It's ingrained in the culture.
You force them. You have to take the decision out of the player's hands. You have to. Because, for one reason, the guy that is least trustworthy in this situation is the guy who has a concussion.
Especially when he might not even be conscious. And I think, to me, that's the only solution. It's to give the concussion spotters more authority and make it mandatory. If the spotter calls someone off the ice,
right,
you take them off the ice. And yes, it's true. I remember at the beginning of the year, Bill Daly said the concussion spotters don't have official medical training, right? But maybe it's a case of changing the profile of who's qualified to be a spotter. Maybe it has to be a physician who's a spotter.
Yeah. And from what I understand, I talked to your babysitter about this, and she said that when you fell that time at the playground and got the concussion, she spotted it, she alerted you and wanted to send you home, but you insisted on staying and playing at the playground, which goes back to, you know, the whole, like, you shouldn't have been trusted in that.
That sounds like me. It's something I would do.
Yeah.
I used to love it.
You had a beard then, right? You were four, what, six?
I was
four,
seven, so I
and
had,
you had,
I had,
and you had the full beard going.
I think I had a goatee because it was like it was the early 90s, so.
Oh, so you were a bit of a hipster then.
I think so.
Yeah.
That was in back then.
Okay, on that note, let's move on and talk about the Montreal Canadiens. As you know, they've not been very good lately. One win in their last 10. They had a terrible January. And this morning they announced that they're not going to give out the Molson Cup to a player of the month for January. What the hell is going on in Montreal? This team has just completely cratered.
I feel that this is a culmination of years of structural neglect. This is a team that was never built to win, and they've been able to mask it because of Carey Price and, to a lesser extent, PK Subban and Andre Markov, who now Markov has fallen off a cliff.
Yep.
This is a team that they haven't had a number one center in years. People talking about firing Therrien. How do you not fire Marc Bergevin at this point? Like, how many good moves has he actually made, other than, like, pulling Thomas Fleischmann off the scrap?
Alexander
heap?
Seven? No? No?
Nothing there? But, like, there's no number one center on the team. There's no number one center in the system.
Wait a second. Their number one center is playing left wing.
And every time he gets
time he gets a chance, they take it away from him.
Right.
And who's doing that? Who's doing that? The guy behind the bench is doing that.
But Bergevin has been behind that for years with Galchenyuk.
Saying
he's not ready, and putting him down. And that, obviously, that's not going to help matters. So, yeah, you have the one option there in Galchenyuk that hasn't happened, you know, it hasn't happened yet. You're in your window right now. You have one of the best goalies in the world when he's healthy in Carey Price. You have one of the best defensemen in the world in PK Subban, who's in his window right now. And you're just frittering it away. And like I said, like, they're not changing it. You look at the last three Stanley Cup winners in terms of franchises, because the Kings and Hawks have won it multiple times. Even go back to Boston. They all had an all-world center.
Yeah.
Andre Kopitar, Patrice Bergeron, who was backed up ably by David Krejci in a sort of 1A, 1B situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Jonathan Toews. Montreal doesn't have anything near that. All those teams had great goaltenders at the same time. I just don't understand how what's Montreal's goal here? Washington is clearly past them. Tampa Bay is clearly past them.
Columbus is clearly past them. Buffalo passed them last night.
Yeah.
Their last three losses, if I'm not mistaken, have been two to Columbus, one to Buffalo, the two worst teams in the league, right?
Yeah,
right.
Like, that's right, right?
Yeah.
No wonder they're not giving the friggin' trophy to anybody. They should give it to Carey Price. That's who they should
give
it to.
Sure. And to support that theory, here's the crazy thing about the Habs season. It's very ironic. Last year, they were the one-man team, the Carey Price team, that had bad possession numbers. This year, the Habs have very good possession numbers.
Yeah, they're like sixth in the
league. They have a low shooting percentage, so we could actually argue that their puck luck is bad. And that would support the idea that they're going to actually turn it around. And I think it really is Carey Price's absence this year. And if Price is in the lineup, they might still be a very good team. It's not the same team as last year, at least.
But where are they taking their shots playing from?
That I don't know. I don't have a camera. I don't track it that closely.
That would be my sort of concern.
How many red zone shots are we looking at?
Yeah.
And you know what? When you look at the Habs and the way that team is configured and made up, you got like one guy who goes to the red zone all the time.
Yeah.
And he wears number 11.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys who don't. Probably Dale Weiss goes to the red zone quite a bit, too. And he's got, I mean, he had 8 goals in his first, 15 games, and now he's got 12. I get the fire tearing thing here because, I mean, maybe he's not the problem, but he obviously doesn't have the answers. He doesn't have the answers at this point. The players look like they've tuned him out, and their whole body language now is like, you know, they get down, you know, at the first sign of adversity, it's like, hey boys, okay, let's get the tent poles out, we're folding this baby up, and we're out of here, you know.
Well, you know what they remind me of? Almost is there a tanking thing going on? The analogy I use is when I was in university, I used to know guys and gals who they were too afraid to end a relationship, so they started being mean to their partners, hoping to get dumped. I know a guy used to do this. It was despicable. He would act like a douche. It was not me. I would never do that.
Yeah.
But I know someone who did that, and he would act horrible to his partner, hoping to get dumped because he didn't want to do it himself. And it kind of reminds me, are the Habs just sort of trying to be bad just long enough to get Therrien fired, and then they'll start playing better again? Are they just quitting on him and hoping that he gets fired soon enough? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't get the sense that they hate the guy.
No.
Or that they think he's a buffoon or anything like that.
But they're playing
just,
like a team.
It just seems like he's lost the room. And I've talked to coaches about this, that when you lose the room and you lose credibility, done. You're done. It never comes back. You are done. And I'm starting to wonder if that's not the case with this team for whatever reason. You know, I mean, they've got to do something at some point. I mean,
and do they have to do it sooner than later? I mean, can they just sit and wait for Carey Price to come back and that'll flip the switch? Or, you know, we're into February now. How much longer can you wait? Because they're falling further and further out of the playoffs.
I think they're toast this year. And I saw this, you know, online this morning that perhaps the best situation is just let Carey Price fully heal, takes as much time as he wants. They could potentially get Austin Matthews. They are putting themselves in a position where, like, keep in mind, it's a lottery, and they won't have the best odds necessarily. Columbus is still going to finish behind them, probably either Edmonton or Calgary. But, I mean, if they're within striking distance, they could get that number one center that is so hard to procure if you don't put your efforts in the right place.
And if you don't get Austin Matthews, then you get, you know, Puljujarvi or Lane or
something. And those guys are wingers.
The triple lottery.
Yeah, no, but
they're still really good.
Yeah,
maybe that covers up a bit of your inefficiencies. But, I mean, the only thing this year is if you're looking for a number one center, Matthews is kind of your only option. Your next closest option, I would say, would be either Mikey McLeod in Mississauga or Tyson Jost with Penticton, who's committed to North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And those guys are, I mean, like Austin Matthews is elite, incredible, you know, like probably would have gone before Eichel last year, you know, the way scouts are talking about him and the way they sort of stack things up. With the other guys, there's a bit more of, they're not sure things, but they're pretty excellent players, but they're not going to help you next year. Austin Matthews would help you next year. And again, going back to that whole idea of the Habs window, where, you know, you do need to win pretty soon, because as an amazing athlete as Subban is, like, he's only human. Like, how many more years is he going to be that elite, you know, going for the Norris defenseman? And at one point, are you just kind of wasting Carey Price's time?
It's true. And I think, you know, people could talk about, should Marc Bergevin act desperately? Should he become a buyer at the deadline? But to me, it doesn't matter what you get. You can name them. Dustin Byfuglien, Andrew Ladd, Eric Staal. You could bring in all three of those guys somehow. The money wouldn't work, but let's say hypothetically.
Wow.
And if Carey Price is not back, none of it matters.
True. And I watched Eric Staal play last night against Calgary, and he did nothing. Nothing. Like, I didn't even know. Like, I didn't even notice him.
Are you sure it wasn't Jared Staal?
I think it was Henry Staal, the father. I think he was playing.
It was Jared. Yeah. It was Jared Staal. They brought him up.
Yeah. Anyways, I mean, they're five behind Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh has three games in hand right now, and Pittsburgh's trending upwards, and Montreal's trending the other way. You know, what are they, they've lost 21 of their last 26?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was they only lost 11 points in their first 26 games, and they've only gained 11 points in their next 26 games.
Yeah, it's stark.
Yeah.
Not good. Not good in Montreal.
No. They're going to throw the torch out, too. You guys can't have the torch. We're not passing it to you.
Yeah, exactly, because your guys are picking it up by the flame part.
All right, well, speaking of Austin Matthews and number one picks, let's talk about Connor McDavid, who returned this week. Came back Tuesday night, scored a nice goal. And, Ryan, you wrote sort of the case for how he can still win the Calder despite missing so much time. You know, he's going to finish with maybe 45 games this year. What does that look like? How does he still stay in the Calder discussion?
Well, for me, and I will admit, it's a bit of a cynical path, if you will, but I think if he can put up at least a point per game,
mm-hmm.
Maybe even more, then he'll finish with about 57 to 60 points in 45 games. He would by far have the best points per game of anybody, of any rookie in the league, maybe just any player in the league for that matter. I think, you know, because these awards are voted on by sports writers, I think there's a narrative that they want McDavid to win, or at the least, they don't want Artemi Panarin in Chicago to win because, you know, he's older, he's already 24, played in the KHL for a bunch of years, gets to ride shotgun with Patrick Kane, the most dynamic player in the game today. So I feel that there's going to be some biases towards Panarin, and he's going to have to really make his case to win it, especially with Dylan Larkin playing such an amazing two-way game in Detroit.
Yeah.
So if McDavid can put up a good amount of points, if he can get that great points per game pace, I think there's going to be a lot of writers out there who say, if he didn't break his hand, he would have run away with the scoring title. He was still the best rookie.
The clavicle, sorry.
Yeah. Not only that, but I mean, Edmonton's in last right now with McDavid. They're probably going to go up a little bit, and it doesn't really matter. They're going to play loose from now on. I was joking the other day that they have Ottawa next. I don't know who's going to win, but it's going to be 6-5. There's no question that's going to be a goal fest.
Yeah.
And
they play Montreal this weekend.
Montreal. Yeah, exactly. So he's going to get his points, whether the Oilers win or lose in a shootout. It almost doesn't matter at this juncture. They're going to play fast and loose, just like Columbus did last year when they were way out of it. So he'll get his points. They might rise in the standings a little bit, not enough to threaten for a playoff spot, but enough to look good if you just looked at the season on paper afterwards. And I think there's a lot of things that point to him. You look at the highlight goals, you look at the effect he's had on that team and that market, and a lot of writers, I think, will say, he was the best rookie. I don't care that he missed the time.
Well, if you leave it up to the NHL, the Professional Hockey Writers Association, he'll be named... He'll be named to the all rookie team as a defenseman.
Yeah, he'll get the notice.
I thought Eric Karlsson was good, but McDavid was pretty good as a defenseman.
He backchecks more now.
Well, like I just picked up Connor McDavid in my hockey pool, so I'm like thrilled about
what hockey pool has Connor McDavid available in. What a terrible hockey pool! I want in.
Well, it's It's kind of hard to explain, but anyways, there's a reason why he was dropped. We picked him up anyways. So so I'm hoping that he keeps up what he was doing. So if he scores 3 points a game the rest of the way, he gets 93 points in the last 31 games, plus the 12 he had. That puts him at 105.
That's a
lot. That'd be good. That'd be good for rookie year. I think that would do it. The year Pavel Bure won, this reminds me of the year Pavel Bure won, but Pavel Bure played 65 games that year. I think in the end, you know, unless he goes bonkers,
yeah,
like you say, like unless he actually scores a point a game, like every game scores a point or two, and he clearly separates himself from the pack, then I think he has a good chance to win it. But I just don't know that 45 games is going to be a big enough sample size for people to give it to him. That's the sense that I get. Like I said, unless he goes bananas.
Yeah. The thing is, I think he will go bananas because he is bananas good. and to me, if you look at Kane and Panarin, in my opinion, the Calder and the Hart and the Art Ross, well, the Hart and Art Ross in one category and the Calder, they're mutually exclusive. Because if you're up for the Calder, but you're playing with the person voted the most valuable player in the league, who has the most points in the league, how can you get the credit for your performance?
Okay, but Patrick Kane has 73 points. He's like 16 points ahead of the next guy. He's got a huge, you know, is there a chance here that maybe playing with Artemi Panarin has brought out the best in Patrick Kane?
Yeah.
Maybe he's made Patrick Kane a more valuable player. Maybe he's made him better. Maybe he's given him more options. And maybe Patrick Kane owes a little bit of his success to Artemi Panarin. And if that's the case, then, like, to me, Artemi Panarin's a rookie. Max Domi's a rookie. Connor McDavid's a rookie.
Yeah.
Okay? So you can't say that because a guy's 18 years old and he had this many points, it's better than a guy who's 23 or 22 or whatever Panarin is,
yeah,
right?
Agreed. Rookies are rookies.
Yeah. Like, if you're a rookie, you're a rookie. Or a first-year player, if that's the parameter, and I'll have a vote, that will be the parameter upon which I decide my vote. Who was the best first-year player, regardless of how old or how young he was?
And keep in mind, playing with elite players is not as easy as it sounds. You look at the problems that Pittsburgh has had the past couple of years, finding line mates for Sidney Crosby.
Yeah.
I mean, this Panarin was a gift to Chicago, the way that he has melded with Patrick Kane. And, you know, it reminds me just, you know, a player that's up for the draft this year, Alex DeBrincat in Erie. Small kid, but can wire the puck. Last year, he was line mates with Connor McDavid.
Yeah.
DeBrincat went off, had more than 50 goals. This year, his center is Dylan Strome, another elite player. DeBrincat's probably going to score 50 again. When DeBrincat went to Team USA's World Junior Camp, immediately clicked with Austin Matthews, the best player on that team. Those guys don't play the same way. Strome likes to slow it down. Matthews likes to control it. McDavid likes to go up and down fast. But DeBrincat is the constant. He can always find points. Now, the World Juniors didn't work out because, you know, he got booted from a game and then he got hurt. And then he couldn't really fit his way back on a line. But the potential was there, and Ron Wilson recognized right away that those guys were going to be... Like, DeBrincat didn't even play the exhibition game. Wilson just said, no, he's on the team. I don't even need to see him. And I think, you know, that's what we're seeing with Panarin, is that he can play with the best in the game, and he can make contributions. And like you say, I mean, Kane's having his best year, and he's never won a Hart Trophy before.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a bit of a symbiosis there where you do have to give credit, and you have to say, like, it's not easy playing with those guys where you always have to be ready for a pass, because the mind of Patrick Kane, the mind of Sidney Crosby is working on a different level from even most NHLers.
Yeah, yeah.
Panarin gets that.
Aside from the fact that I don't think symbiosis is a word.
It probably
is. No, symbiotic is a word, but I'm not sure that... We'll have to look it up.
I think symbiosis is the process of
symbiosis?
Coming together.
I've never heard that word before, ever.
It's when a parasite binds with the toast. Symbiosis? Am I
right?
Am I right?
I don't know. You might be. That's actually the only quibble I have with everything you said, because I think it does take a special player to be able to detect the rhythms and flows and ebbs and all that of an elite player. And as you say, like a guy like DeBrincat's a good example. I mean, McDavid is a guy who, like, he gets the puck, he goes over the blue line with speed, and you think he's at top speed, and then he finds another gear with the puck.
Right.
Like, I'm not sure I've seen a guy this fast with the puck since the guy I just talked about a few minutes ago, Pavel Bure. Like, I'm not sure I've seen a guy that can play with the puck at the speed that he plays at since Burry, right? So, I mean, yeah, no, I'm getting off topic here, but it does take, and this goes back to Panarin, I think it does take a pretty special player to be able to play with a player like that and to come in and not be intimidated by it and to just be able to roll with it. I think there's a lot to be said for that.
And I agree, and I should be clear, I'm not knocking Panarin. I think Panarin's been outstanding, and we've seen, you know, look how long it's taken Tuukka Rantanen to become the lead player in Chicago. Playing with great line mates has not happened yet. I
right.
Look at Sergei Plotnikov in Pittsburgh. He's been a complete bust. But that said, if you take Panarin and you drop him onto the Edmonton Oilers, does he produce the same way Connor McDavid does? And ultimately, we're comparing, by the end of the year, who is the better player.
Right.
And I still think, as good as Panarin has been, and he's going to be great, I think, all year, I think that we'll be able to say McDavid was an even more dominant player than Panarin. And McDavid, I think, is a guy who can make others around him better, even more so than Panarin.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
All right. Thanks, guys. And that's all the time for this week. Tune in next week when we give you the definition of symbiosis and symbiotic.